I'll do my best to keep you awake, but no promises, as this is kind of a legalistic type of presentation. So without further ado, I'll start. So what we're going to be talking about today is learning lessons from the SARS and H1N1 outbreaks, and specifically looking at the effectiveness of the international health regulations, which were revised in 2005. To begin, I have no relationships to disclose in relation to this presentation. I want to give you guys a brief overview of what I'll be going over today. First, we'll be talking about the increased importance of travel and trade in the globalization of diseases. And we'll talk about the first crisis, which was SARS. And we should note that this is a pre-IHR 2005 disease, so the international health regulations weren't revised at that time and didn't require certain reporting requirements. So that impacted the global spread of the disease. Next, we'll talk about the response, which was the revised international health regulations. International soft law that addresses lots of disease reporting. And then we'll talk about the second crisis, which was the first systemic test of this new system. And that was, of course, the swine flu outbreak. We'll then talk about lessons learned and potential policy solutions to address any gaps in our current system. And I think it's interesting because a lot of this comes off of a lot of interest generated from the movie Contagion, where we're still aware that these type of trade and policy issues can impact diseases, specifically in relation to international travel. The World Tourism Organization, a specialized UN agency, estimates that 1 billion people will travel in 2011. That's the first time we'll hit that mark. With an increase of 7% in 2010 and an expected increase of 4 to 5% in 2011, I think it's pretty telling that even in a global economic recession, we still have increases in international travel. So what this means is that as humans, as a vector for diseases, international travel lets people rapidly spread diseases quickly. And a lot of you are probably business travelers. Some people go to multiple destinations in one time. You can rapidly spread a pathogen quite quickly all over the world. So that's a difference, and that's a measure of globalization. So the first crisis, SARS, is a pretty good example of this, and it occurred in 2002, later contained in 2003, spread to 37 countries, close to a global pandemic, estimated around 8,000 persons have impacted, about 800 deaths. Of course, this is WHO statistics, so take that with a grain of salt, but that's the primary statistics we use. The case fatality rate on this was pretty high, 14 to 15%. Transmission modality was direct to human contact, and of course it spread through globalization. In 2002, we still had a lot of international travel at that point. Most importantly, it was exacerbated by political and primarily economic concerns of China at the onset of the disease, so they failed to report in a timely manner. And this was a pre-IHR 2005 disease. So to illustrate the international travel of this disease, we have one infected index case, a physician who left Guangdong, and he spent one night in the ninth floor of a hotel. I think if you're on the ninth floor, you're probably in a pretty nice suite. But anyway, he stayed there, and visitors that went to the ninth floor actually seeded outbreaks to more intra-regional areas, places like Hong Kong, Vietnam, and Singapore. And then these cases seeded other outbreaks to more countries which have close social and economic ties with China, including Toronto, was a popular destination. The economic and trade impact of this particular disease was quite severe. Hong Kong, Vietnam, Singapore, and Canada, of course, spread linked to air travel routes. 41% decline for East Asia tourism during this time. $1.3 billion loss for China, $2 billion loss just for the province of Ontario, and an estimated $100 billion loss as a macro impact for the whole world. And it's important to note in number three here, that's just money lost from tourism. So if you talk about the spillover effect, it could be a lot higher. So the international community recognized that there were some limitations to the existing international health regulation framework, as it only really covered traditional quarantinable diseases such as cholera, plague, and yellow fever, and couldn't really address these emerging and novel diseases. So in response to that, the revised IHR 2005 expanded the scope of any reportable disease to what was called a public health emergency of international concern. And that is something that is determined by the World Health Organization in consultation with an advisory group. So again, this spreads the scope of the international health regulations. It casts a wide net for anything that could constitute a public health emergency. It also required 24 hours reporting to the WHO of any potential PHEIC, and it has a sort of matrix to tell countries what could constitute a PHEIC. It also requires capacity building for disease surveillance in countries, and most importantly, included language that public health interventions should not unduly interfere with international trade and travel, recognizing that public health interventions, there's a sort of balancing of the priorities between impacting travel and trade and also protecting your country from transmission of diseases. So specific to trade and travel, WHO can issue temporary recommendations for country response. WHO did this during SARS. It issued travel advisories, which were pretty unprecedented. If you issue a travel advisory against a country, they're going to get less tourism. So it has economic impact on that side as well. That state-based public health responses, of course, should minimize interference with international traffic and trade. And also that if states do engage in measures that are more restrictive, they have to provide scientific evidence to back that up. And capacity building at border points. So it wasn't too long. IHR is called IHR 2005 because that's when it was adopted, but it wasn't actually implemented until 2007. And it got its first real big test 2 years later, which was really amazing, actually, when you think about the framework was only in place for 2 years, and then it got its first test with the first global pandemic since the Spanish flu. So this was a big test for the IHR 2005. The H1N1 virus was a global pandemic beginning in 2009. And the most important thing here, I think, is that it originally had a high case fatality rate because a lot of non-fatal cases weren't being reported. But we'll talk about a little bit more about the dynamics behind this one. And most importantly, it's a post-IHR 2005 disease, so we can sort of assess the effectiveness of the international health regulations as they were designed to increase the ability for the international community to respond to global pandemics. So again, similar to what we talked about in SARS, we had cases in Mexico first identified, though it's possible that most of the original index cases may have originated in the United States, actually. And then, less than a month later, it had already spread to the U.S. and several European countries. And this was despite the fact that Mexico acted very proactively. So in difference to China, they acted quickly, and they acted with a lot of public health measures that were designed to prevent the spread of the disease. The trade and economic impact, it was similarly severe. Mexico instituted broad-based public health responses, shutting down really all of Mexico City for about a week or so. Estimated $2.3 billion loss during the spring of that period. And despite these efforts, despite these very proactive efforts, trade and travel restrictions were issued unilaterally by other countries. Most egregiously, 20 countries placed a ban on the meat products from Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. So this picture here shows Egyptian officials killing about, or slaughtering, or culling, whatever phrase you want to use, about 20,000 pigs. No scientific evidence, unfortunately, to show that meat had any part of the disease transmission. And then this ad below is by PETA, saying that meat kills, and advocating for vegetarian to go vegetarian, and it mentions swine flu. I think it's a very creative ad, but not much scientific evidence to back that up. The World Health Organization and the World Health Animal Organization put out a statement saying that, you know, meat didn't have anything to do with the transmission of the disease. So how did the IHR work during H1N1? First, one of the things it did do well is it did increase surveillance requirements for countries, member states, and Mexico arguably did report in a timely manner. It also aggressively instituted mitigation strategies, part of the capacity building required under the IHR. Mexico's economy was shut down. Travel and trade restrictions were imposed by other countries, and Mexico suffered a $2.3 billion loss. So even though Mexico did act very proactively, especially compared to China, it still suffered trade sanctions, even though the IHR says that you shouldn't issue trade or travel restrictions that aren't supported by scientific evidence. So the restriction on imports of pork meat, et cetera, those were not, there was not a proper recourse for Mexico during this time. And another thing that's quite interesting, I think, from this case is that the disease did continue to spread globally, despite the social distancing and all the public health interventions that really Mexico took. That's another lesson. I'm not sure exactly what the implications of that are, because they did use best efforts. I won't go over this whole timeline, but basically IHR came into effect actually in 1851, and then SARS outbreak occurred. A response was revising the international health regulations, and again, H1N1 came about after that. So the lessons we can learn, the primary lessons we can take away are that IHR 2005 was designed to address some of the limitations of the SARS response, and Mexico did act proactively, but economic and trade sanctions were still levied against it, not supported by scientific evidence. This questions the incentive needed for reporting for PHEICs under the current framework, because if you're a country who's highly dependent on agricultural commodities as an export, you might look at the Mexico case study and give it a second thought, because you really don't have much protection against these trade and travel restrictions. And then there's other issues that overlap in this space. Growing threat of prion infections in the food supply, including BSE, and including more disease surveillance in venison meat of prion infections as well, so in deer. Conflict between WHO and Indonesia over virus sample sharing, which led to the WHO pandemic influenza preparedness negotiation, and that addressed some of that. And of course, the recent ban on vegetables from the EU, from the E. coli outbreak by Russia. I think it was beets that were considered the original origin of that E. coli outbreak, but the Spanish cucumbers got the worst of it, and they arguably weren't the cause. So we do have a potential policy solution to address this. First, we need to recognize that we need to balance the interests of public health and economic and travel and trade, and we need an immediate form to effectively address these issues. And the way we feel that this can be done is by leveraging the respective expertise of the World Trade Organization and the World Health Organization in a joint committee. So what that could look like is it could be a specific forum to address travel and trade disputes for PHEICs under the IHR 2005. It would be a joint adjudication process adapting a streamlined dispute settlement body for expedited review of PHEICs. And when I say streamlined, I mean faster than the current WTO dispute settlement body, which can take a very long time. 6 months for the first part, and then the second part is an appellate process. So if you're in a public health emergency, that may not be very conducive to resolving an issue. So we're talking about a streamline, something that can really address a public health emergency, because Mexico really didn't have any redress. They approached the WTO, but WTO and some other international organizations issued a statement, and it didn't help any of the travel and trade issues that were imposed against it. That this committee should be adjudicate these issues, and that it should be constantly involved in evaluation to support scientifically based policymaking. Requirements for participation we feel are necessary, because that can also strengthen the existing international health regulation framework. Anyone wanting to participate in this particular alternative dispute resolution, I guess you could call it, or adjudication process, would have to agree to the requirements of the IHR, including 24-hour reporting, adherence to WHO recommendations, submission of scientific rationale, also submission of economic assessment impact by countries who think they're going to have some economic injury, and compliance with the surveillance requirements, but with consideration for these developing countries, because they really don't have the money to develop these disease surveillance systems, and they really should be helped because this is part of our global health security. Exemptions for clear and present dangers, I won't go over these too much. And then the last slide, I think there's five of us, so I wasn't exactly sure what the time frame was. I hope I didn't go over. So usually they give you a little flag, but there's nobody here, so I apologize. So current weaknesses of the system, I'll just go over real quickly, are WHO authority and expertise is really limited to public health issues. And even if the WHO says, oh, don't do this, and you can't do these type of trade and travel restrictions, its authority is really limited to public health issues. So it needs to partner with an organization that has purview over this particular area, and that would be, of course, the WTO. So we think that these two agencies should actually work together. I know that's kind of hard. I was in Geneva this summer with the WHO as a summer intern, and you know, intergovernmental working is kind of hard, but they're doing some work in that space. So I think this is an appropriate forum for this. The current WTO dispute settlement body is slow, so we need an expedited dispute settlement process. It does not currently incentivize disease reporting, and I think the main takeaway here is we're worried about the next global pandemic and what will happen if a country has either a foodborne illness outbreak or even perhaps something more virulent as a pathogen. Are they going to be properly incentivized to report the disease, or are they going to have so much fear of economic sanctions because they don't have redress in the current system that they won't report it, and they may try to contain it locally? So we want to make sure that doesn't happen, and we want to give these countries a forum to address these particular issues. So thanks again, and thanks for being patient with no organization here. So thank you.